reevaluate that.
I asked Joe, he makes his t-shirts himself. Having done it with my children, I'm very impressed.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Before we actually start the City Council meeting this morning, we have some folks here on a very happy day of a proclamation. And I see Courtney Duke is here, along with Sarah Schooley and Barbara Rice. Thanks for coming. I will read this proclamation, bring you up to receive it, and hear anything you have to say on the subject. So thanks for being here. Good morning. Come on up. Whereas residents of this region know that its greatness and success is a direct result of all residents, regardless of gender, making creative, intelligent, and revolutionary contributions to society, and whereas women have been historically underrepresented, yet played and continue to play important roles internationally, nationally, regionally, and locally in furthering knowledge and promoting positive social change, and whereas to foster the next generation of women, the City of Portland seeks to encourage and support professional, educational, and social opportunities for women in order to ensure that opportunities that may have not have existed in the past are available in the present and into the future, and whereas Women's History Month is a time for all Portlanders to remember the stories and teachings of the many women who made and continue to make improvements for the livability of the city, region, and world, and whereas during Women's History Month, all Americans are encouraged to reflect on past victories and struggles of women to create a society where our daughters can reach their full potential, unobstructed by gender. Now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim March 1 to March 31, 2013, to be Women's History Month in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this day. Congratulations, and let's hear it for the women leaders in our community. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Hales and Council. My name is Sarah Schooley, and I'm an employee of the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Thank you for having us today to formally proclaim and celebrate March as Women's History Month. The Women's Affinity Group for the City of Portland has organized a variety of events this month, ranging from our kickoff breakfast, films, and panels to remind and educate city staff on the roles of women in creating the city we live in today. For 2013, the national theme of Women's History Month is Women Inspiring Innovation Through Imagination, and focuses on honoring generations of women who throughout history have used their intelligence, imagination, sense of wonder, and tenacity to make extraordinary contributions to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, also known as STEM. We at the City of Portland have adopted this national theme, and our events focused around learning about and supporting city staff women that work in these STEM fields. I have two events that I would specifically like to highlight. The first is a panel of female staff titled Breaking Through the Bias, City Women in STEM Fields, which will be held on March 26th in the Portland Building Auditorium. We will be talking with staff from BES, BTS, PBOT, and BPS, to learn about how they chose their professions and their experience working for the city as a female. This panel will be facilitated by Mayor Hale's Chief of Staff, Gail Shibley, and I encourage all of you to attend. Secondly, I would like to encourage you and any city employee to nominate female mentors, leaders, and exceptional coworkers for the Wonder Women Awards. The nominated women will be honored on Wednesday, March 27th, also in the Portland Auditorium, with the Aurora Chorus. I look forward to seeing you there. Lastly, even as the number of women in the workplace has increased, we still have a way to go. 51% of residents in the city of Portland are women, yet just 32% of Portland city employees are women. This is a gap that is slowly closing and needs to be continually worked on. As a female, trained in engineering and city planning, I am proud to be one of this 32%. And look forward to meeting the future women that the city will employ. With that, I would like to introduce Barbara Rice and Courtney Duke, who will speak about their experience with the City of Portland and why Women's History Month is an important time of year to pause and reflect.
Thanks, Sarah.
Okay, you can go ahead. Hey, my name is Barbara Rice, and I'm with the Portland Water Bureau. I've been a part of this planning committee, for 4 or 5 years, and I always look forward to this month. Not just because it's women in history, but the many women that are employed by the City of Portland and I feel as a part of that very, very, very closely. An email was sent out regarding the proclamation, and my manager read that email, and she sent a reply to Janice McDonald, who is the chair of the Women's Affinity Group, and she said in her email reply that it reminded her, the proclamation reminded her of the many women, powerful and strong, that had impacted her in her lifetime. I too feel that way. There are many women, especially many women in the city of Portland, through my years here, that have impacted my seeing and the learnings that I have done from within the city of Portland. And so I encourage all of you, the commissioners and mayor, and all the city employees of Portland to come and be a part of the events that we have planned for this month. They're great events. I know you will enjoy them all. And if you don't know the events that we're having, we sent out a calendar at the beginning of the month, but you can go to portlandonline.com with the diverse and empowered employees and look up those events and attend which ones will meet your schedules.
Great.
So thank you for having us here, and I'm proud to be a part of the 32% of the women that are employed by the city of Portland.
Thank you, Barbara.
Hi, good morning. I'm Courtney Duke with the Bureau of Transportation. I've been at the city 17 years. I started when I was really young. But eight of those, as of February 13th, eight of those has been as a working mom. On behalf of the City of Portland City Mamas Group, it's also known as the Working Moms Affinity Group, we say thank you to the council and to the city for supporting women and working moms here at the city. One way that that's done is the on-site daycare that we have, flexible work schedules, and paid sick leave. We are encouraging the over 100 moms that are on our email list as a part of the Working Moms Affinity Group, as well as all the working moms and parents here at the city to participate in Women's History Month events, and we have worked with the Affinity Group to work on some of those events. We are very grateful and support and glad that the council both supports the Women's Affinity Group as well as all the affinity groups and the Working Moms Group through the activities of DEEP and all of our affinity groups.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Here you are. It's official.
Thank you.
Let's hear it.
Thank you.
Add that to your list.
Well, there are probably some other stories up here among the council members. Mine is that the first time I served in this room was with Mayor Vera Katz, and she was a great leader and a great mentor. And she also participated in that wonderful tradition of Bring Your Daughters to Work Day, and I brought my daughter to work so that she could spend time with Mayor Katz, and I think it really inspired her. So the mentorship part is pretty important. Other comments, reflections from the council? Thank you all. Thanks very much, and we'll all look forward to the events of the month. So, council, please come to order and call the roll, please.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish? Saltzman?
Here.
Novick?
Here.
Hales?
Here. All right.
My daughter would kill me if I mentioned her.
Caitlin says, don't do that, Dad. Okay, communications items first, please.
Item 180, request of Aaron Cornell to address council regarding neighborhood crime and the Office of Crime Prevention.
Morning, welcome.
Morning.
3 minutes, just put your name in the record. And if you're representing a group, just let us know.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. My name is Aaron Cornell, and I'm here today to make sure you're aware of the great work being done by the City of Portland's Office of Crime Prevention, and specifically about the impact that office has had on my neighborhood. I've lived in Northeast Portland on 85th Avenue, just north of Fremont, for 7 years. My house is just three short blocks off of 82nd Avenue, and drug and prostitution activity is rampant there. My house has been broken into, and cars pull over for me if I go for a walk. I consider myself a pretty strong person, but over the last 7 years, I remained isolated from my neighbors because I had no tools to discern who I could trust, and I did not know how to go about creating change. Last fall, I learned about the Office of Crime Prevention, and I made a phone call to Brad Taylor, the crime prevention coordinator for my neighborhood. Brad came out to my house, did an assessment of my home, and made recommendations for what I could do to deter crime on my property. Brad also gave me the tools I needed to start a neighborhood watch program. With his help, we've organized a group of 33 neighbors and counting. Brad provided crime prevention training, including the right and wrong ways to illuminate our properties, the specifications for effective door locks, the importance of keeping our bushes trimmed, and the positive impact of territoriality. That's that feeling that you get when you step onto a well-maintained property, that you're in someone else's space, and that space is cared for. The prostitution coordination team, which is made up of 4 police officers and a deputy district attorney, also attended our first neighborhood watch meeting. They encouraged us to call the police when we see prostitution activity in our neighborhood, as well as emailing them with as many details about both the prostitute and the John as we can. They have promised to follow up on every reported license plate belonging to a car seen picking up a woman in my neighborhood. My neighbors and I are now preparing to begin foot patrols. Brad Taylor will conduct a training teaching us what we need to know to stay safe while deterring crime simply by walking around and having a presence on our streets. We'll go out together at least once a month, and it'll be a time to get to know one another better while also preventing crime. In the 5 short months since becoming involved with the Office of Crime Prevention, we have evolved from neighbors living in isolated silos to neighbors that are in regular contact and wave to each other on the streets. We are sharing information about criminal activity we witness, and more importantly, we're brainstorming ways to curtail it. We are caring for each other's homes when neighbors go out of town. We are talking about becoming involved in a food co-op and sharing information about how we can support a Friends of Trees work group coming to our neighborhood. We are also investigating what it would take to turn a vacant lot, currently an eyesore and crime magnet, into a community garden. We are planning summer barbecues and looking into blocking off our streets for a big block party. To think that I have lived alongside most of these people for the past 7 years and I've never even seen most of them. Thanks to the support from the Office of Crime Prevention, I now feel safer in my home and empowered to create positive change in my neighborhood. I encourage you to lend your support to this very important office as they continue to support Portlanders to create not only safer neighborhoods, but stronger communities. Thank you very much for having me here this morning.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for getting involved in your neighborhood and for taking the time to come to talk to us.
Thank you.
Okay, next one, please.
Item 181, request of Mark White to address council regarding community development in Powellhurst, Gilbert.
Morning, Mark.
Hi. So thank you for having me again. My name is Mark White. I'm president of the Powellhurst-Gilbert Neighborhood Association. I've provided a packet. I'm going to go over the details really quickly because there's only 3 minutes and there's a lot to talk about. But very specifically, I want to make sure that the council knows that what we're asking for is essentially for council to speak with the Portland Development Commission to ask them to reverse their decision on the purchase of a property for Gilbert Place. And just as some context, the ask that we have, it comes to less than 0.2% of the total remaining indebtedness for the urban renewal area. So it's not really very much at all. There's 2 tracks that the community will benefit from this project. It's a multi-use development that has economic development as part of it. In fact, it's probably the main thrust of it. I'll use my street as an example of how it benefits long-term residents. On my street, you'll see a page in there of the loss of value of properties on my street. There's 25 properties. $2.3 million has been lost in the last couple of years. The average loss is 40%. So what that means is essentially almost half of folks' retirement is gone, which means that aging in place is not an option. It's something that's going to be mandatory. So having something close by to walk to as far as retail is going to be extremely important. As far as our other residents who are low income who've moved into the area, I use Leander Court as an example. I've attached a sheet from Leander Court that shows that of the 37 units there, there's now 190 residents. 120 of them are children, 70 of them are adults. The underemployment rate is 65%. That's up 5% from what it was a couple of years ago. There's also a copy of a survey in there that about a third of the residents participated in that shows that they're clearly interested in starting their own business and have some skills that will translate into that. So one of the things that I'd like folks to think about is affordable housing, for the most part, I think, is thought of as a lifeboat. But is it really a lifeboat if there's no oars and there's no sails for people to move forward in a positive direction? Because the turnover at Leander Court is very, very low. So most of the people who filled out that survey 3-4 years ago are probably still there, and their lives have not changed or possibly have gotten worse. So Gilbert Place is the tool that can help provide them with the ability to move forward. So that's really what we're asking for, is really just the chance to try and get something happen. Because while we understand that there's lots of things that that are really challenging about this project, and with big challenges comes high risk, but really the only risk, rather the biggest risk is probably failure, but really ultimately the biggest failure is not to try. And we're willing to try, and we need your support in order to make that happen. So thank you very much for having me, and I hope to hear from you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for all your great advocacy. A lot of time that you put in. Thank you. Okay, next one, please.
182, request of Mary Eng to address council regarding the fluoride, breast cancer connection, and Nazis and sexual harassers in the Portland police.
Okay, hi guys. Nice to see you all. The first item in the packet is the zero tolerance of harassment and discrimination memo from General Petraeus at the CIA. And I think as a model statement, we need to have this kind of clearness about how we feel about inappropriate leg touching, sexual jokes, sexual pictures, and sexual harassment prevention. So something along these lines, we can settle for nothing less than that kind of clarity. If we move on, the next item is from breastcancerchoices.org, some very important information on issues pertaining to breast cancer, any kind of endocrine disruption. This will also affect male cancers as well. And so our cancer patients in Portland should not be permitted to drink the fluoridated water. So I hope you guys can figure out something to do with a water supply for cancer victims. I'm sure all of you have had loved ones or friends who have died because of cancer. And so we don't want to be pumping this into the water without some help for the cancer victims. The next item is from the Rose City Anti-Fascists. I received a memo on the expo line from some young kids who were very concerned about a Nazi on our police force. And due to the fact that I moved back and forth between Los Angeles and Portland a couple of times, I'm kind of out of touch. And to me, this kind of dark secret about the Portland police makes me wonder what other kinds of dark secrets are going on here in Portland. And I wanted to draw your attention to Maxine Bernstein's excellent research on sexual harassment in the police force. She's consulted with some legal scholars, and some clarity on this and some leadership from the mayor's office would be really appreciated, because I think we can get our women in law enforcement more interested in their careers, but we've got to make sure that our campuses are safe so women can take their criminology classes and go into law enforcement. Then we need to make sure that they clearly know they will not be harassed. And as for hate crimes and racist crimes and the DOJ investigation into some of the problems with the police, having a Nazi on the police force really sends a message to certain communities. Who are they? Catholics, Jewish people, Black people? It sends the message that we don't care about your hate crime. If you've got a sexual harasser moved over to sex crimes, who are you going to report your rape to when you're raped on Portland State University campus? This is an unbelievably incomprehensible scenario for me in terms of the government. I apologize. It was my goal not to lose my temper today and to be kind to you, and thank you for all the good work that you do.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Next one, please.
183, request of Joe Walsh to address council regarding fluoride.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor. Gentlemen. Commissioner Fritz, I come before you today not really to talk to you, but really to talk to the people that will watch this on TV or the people in this room, because three of you have already officially voted to put fluoride in our water, and the other two have made public statements that you support it. When we speak about putting fluoride in the water, it's almost like a French dessert. Fluoride in water. That's not what you're going to put in the water. You're going to put in an acid. It's called, and I have terrible trouble pronouncing this word, fluorosilic acid. The chemical base for this acid is H2SiF6. F standing for the fluoride, and H standing for hydrogen. And the H, the SI stands for hydrogen silicon. In front of me, I have the material safety data sheet on that acid. First thing it says is it's extremely hazardous in case of skin contact. If you came into contact with this stuff, it'll burn you. And in 1995, there was an accident with the truck delivering this stuff, the fluoride, the water. The truck turned over and created a pool of liquid about 30 feet wide. They had to evacuate 1,500 people out of Daytona. They had to rush 50 people to the hospital because they suffered severe burns to their throat, their nose, and their stomach. They had to evacuate another 2,000 people because they found that the wind had picked up this stuff and put it on trees and houses and lawns. That's what you're going to put into your water. You have a regulation coming into this council that you cannot wear perfume or shaving lotion. And I always wondered why. But I saw a sign at my doctor's office saying the same thing. So I asked him. And he said, the sensitivity of my patients, they are vulnerable. What about the vulnerability of your citizens here? I have diabetes. I take 9 medications. Can any of you sitting on this council tell me what the reaction of this stuff is in my system after you put it in my water? You make me take a shower with it. You put it in my mocha. And I don't like people screwing with my mochas. I like that taste.
Joe, thank you very much.
Rethink this.
Okay, Carl, item 184, request of Richard L. Meyer to address council regarding Portland City Commissioners' public housing policy positions.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. My name is Richard L. Meyer. Governing is about choices. Charlie Hales has made his choice. He has chosen to follow his predecessor, Sam Adams, in supporting the discredited and abhorrent policy of targeted, unlimited neighborhood concentration of public housing and its commensurate need to withhold from the public accurate, complete, and timely public housing statistical data. You have now made yours. With the welcome effective change of a strong mayor form of city government, city commissioners are not only free but obliged to challenge or accept policies affecting every bureau now controlled by Mayor Hales. That is now your job. As a Portland taxpayer, voter, and constituent, I have asked each of you to submit an agenda item calling for a vote in support of a change in public housing policy to that of equitable distribution of public housing. Not one of you has shown the ordinary professional courtesy of a response of any kind. How do each of you explain the dismissal of a legitimate request by a constituent to take an action which is now part of your job description? I have offered to meet with each of you in public or in private on the subject of public housing policy many, many times without response. Hiding from public debate and discussion on a major public policy matter indicates the fear of embarrassment due to an inability to credibly defend a position. This is often referred to as political cowardice, an unwelcome trait in elected public officials. This issue has been in the public domain for more than a decade. It is well known to all of you. You do not need more time to consider which of the two available public housing policies you support. As always, to do nothing is a choice to support the status quo. By effectively changing Portland's form of government to strong mayor, Charlie Hales has given each of you a unique opportunity. You have chosen not to challenge the status quo public housing policy and replace it with a policy of equitable distribution of public housing. This is now your legacy, because there is virtually no chance that after today, March 6, 2013, that you will change your position on this matter for the remainder of your time in public office. I close with this offer. If you know that I am wrong and want to challenge my description of your views on public housing policy, then let me know, and I will arrange to have a public conversation on the matter in front of the largest audience I can find. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's move to consent calendar. I don't believe there have been any requests to remove items from the consent calendar, any today. Then let's proceed.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Approved. Time certain.
Item 185, accept the audit of the comprehensive annual financial reports for fiscal year 2011-2012 and the related communications with those charged with governance, and adopt the management responses to correct the deficiencies in financial reporting controls disclosed in the audit.
Good morning, Auditor Griffin-Vallade.
Good morning. I am LaVon Griffin-Vallade, City Auditor, and with me today from my office is Drummond Kahn and Fiona Earle, and we are here to introduce Jim Lanzarata from Moss Adams, LLP, the audit firm responsible for the statutorily required annual audit of the city's financial statements. Jim will be discussing the results of the firm's audit of the city's comprehensive annual financial report for fiscal year 2011-12. The comprehensive annual financial report is prepared each year by OMF. The Audit Services Division in my office manages the contract with the outside firm for this citywide audit. Management of the contract is a responsibility placed in the auditor's office because the primary auditee is OMF, and it would not be appropriate for that office to also oversee the contract. So a financial statement audit determines whether the city's financial statements fairly present the city's financial position. It's akin to an independent person reviewing your ATM card receipts and bank statements for accuracy. The audit simply tells the city and the public whether the records are accurate. It's important to note that this external audit does not determine whether the city's spending is good or bad, appropriate or inappropriate. Just like an accurate statement from your bank doesn't tell you if you're spending your money on the right things. Finally, auditing standards require that this information be presented to those charged with governance of an organization. In this case, that's you folks, and so that's why we're here.
Great. Okay, well, Mayor Hales and fellow commissioners, thanks for the opportunity to come and complete this process. As LaVon mentioned, it is kind of the culmination of the audit process and part of our audit standards that we get a chance to tell you the results of the audit. We also do that with the bureaus. Certain heads or management of the various bureaus, we had that meeting on Monday this week, so we had a chance to go into a more detailed presentation of the results, and so here's my chance to do so with you. What I'd like to do very briefly is just remind you the nature of what you engaged us to do, or more accurately, what the auditor's office engaged us to do in terms of the external audit. Clearly, to report the results of that, what were our findings, what's the nature of the opinion that we issued on the financials, We have issued to you a written communication that we're required to do. So there are several topics that the audit standards say we need to discuss with you. So we've done that in a written form. I think I just want to hit on a couple of the highlights. I'm assuming that you have had a chance to read that or will get a chance to read that. We have issued a letter, or I should say we're in the process of completing a letter to management. So observations and best practice recommendations, which really don't deserve your time and attention. They're really more designed for management. But there was one observation this year that we're working on that I thought you might be interested in and we might talk about just briefly. So that's what we're here to do today. In terms of the nature of services, clearly we audited the city's financial statements, but you have a number of related entities that you've also engaged us to perform the audit for. So Portland Development Commission is an example, and the Fire, Police, Disability, and Retirement Fund is another element that we performed a separate audit on. We did an audit of the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission for the first time this year, which is a related entity to the city. And we do a separate audit of hydro. Some of the hydroelectric activities of the city and the hydro fund of the city requires a separate financial statement audit and report. So we did all of that. We're here really just to talk to you about the results of the city's audit today. Now, anytime that we do an audit, there's also a requirement that we look at the internal controls that management uses to get the activity and balances reflected in this document correctly. And we have an obligation to share with you the results, so we'll do that today. Now, anytime that you're an Oregon municipal corporation, there are additional state laws that you're required to follow, and as your auditor, I'm required to test your compliance with those. And there's a report in here on those, and we'll talk about that. As you know, you've been very active in the grant markets, getting federal grants. The city expended over $90 million of federal grants in the year that ended June of 2012. And with that comes some additional compliance requirements and some audit activity that we need to do and some reports on that, and we'll talk about that. And then finally, you're very blessed that you've got within your accounting division some folks that are experienced enough to put this document together. There are very few governments in Oregon that are able to have the staff that have the expertise to do this. So auditors tend to put the document together and then turn around and audit it. You know, we really appreciate not having to draft a document that we then turn around and audit. So hats off to your staff for having the ability to put this document together in-house. So let's talk about the audit results then. You know, the main thing you want to know about is, well, what was our overall opinion on these financial statements? And you'll find that on page 11. I think there's a green tab if you've got a printed document in front of you. And I'm not going to read it, but what you want to know about it is that it's what we call in technical terms an unqualified opinion. We did not have to qualify any of the wording for conditions that were outside of the required accounting principles. So in layman's terms, we call it a clean opinion. So basically, as a result of the work that we did, we're able to state that this document accurately portrays the position of the city at the end of the year and the activity that you engaged in during the year. And it has the required disclosures of the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. So I think you've got quite a history of getting clean opinions, and so hats off to you for the management and oversight of your management staff that have to put this together, and all the folks that are involved in that. That's a great accomplishment. Now, I mentioned that we have to test certain compliance with state laws, and there is a report on page 325, and in that there were a couple non-compliance issues that were identified, and those are also reported in your financial statements in a footnote on page 71. So in the state laws, the primary areas that we focus are your compliance with local budget laws and procurement, contracting, public purchasing, and so forth. And there were a couple over expenditures against the appropriated budget. And again, those are spelled out on page 71 in one of the footnotes to your financial statements. And you had two funds that ended the year with a negative fund balance, primarily as a result of incurring costs where you get reimbursements, and there's a lag between the incurrence of the cost and your ability to get the reimbursements on those grants. I think that's the primary reason driving those negative fund balances. So of all the state laws that we tested, just a couple areas of non-compliance are pretty common. You'd rather not have an overexpenditure, but it's difficult with as many funds as the city has and the accruals that happen at year end. Sometimes those do happen. In regards to the federal grant programs, you'll find a report that starts on page 343, and it has in there both the findings for the city, and it also has the findings for the Portland Development Commission in there. And we have already gone before the Portland Development Commission and reported the results of that audit. They have an audit committee, and we've reported and worked with their audit committee as well, so we won't go over those. But there were a couple of findings that are related to the city. So in relation to internal controls over financial reporting, there were two that we identified this year. Unfortunately, there was a grants revenue recognition issue that we identified that resulted in an error in the financials that needed to be corrected. And it's a process that the city goes through to determine an accrual and an entry that needs to be made as part of the financial close and reporting process. And the methodology the city used to determine the appropriate grant revenue or grant receivable at the beginning of the year didn't quite capture all of the receivables that existed. So there was an error. It wasn't material to the financial statements, but it was significant enough that it represents a significant deficiency in controls that we needed to bring to your attention. The other was with Portland Bureau of Transportation as part of the streetcar operation. You've acquired a number of parts that are used, and you've got a parts inventory that sit in a warehouse, and all of that is effectively managed, but the value of that parts inventory should be reflected on your balance sheet as an asset and then expensed as the parts are put into operation. And we actually, your staff identified that that parts inventory had not been reflected as an asset on the balance sheet. And so an entry was made in the current year to get that corrected and on the balance sheet. And that also was, it wasn't a material error, but it was significant enough for us to determine that that was a significant deficiency in controls. And so that's reported in there. In terms of your federal grant compliance, so of the $90 million, I think there were six programs that required our testing as major programs. A couple of those were all under the JAG cluster that are managed by the police department, and we did have a couple findings related to the JAG programs, and that's identified on pages 349 and 350 of that.
What was JAG?
JAG, I knew you were going to ask me that. I should have been prepared to answer that. It's a federal program, and there are a number of Justice Assistance Grant. There you go. And actually, there's a couple programs within the Justice Assistance Grant and a number of specific projects that the police department had requested grants for and were awarded. And within that, there are some compliance requirements that when you purchase services or work with a vendor to buy goods and services that help you administer that grant, that you look to determine that that vendor is not suspended or debarred, not prevented from participating in a project that's funded with federal dollars. And we found one instance out of seven contracts that we looked at where the city had not checked or had documented that they had checked to determine that the vendor was not on that list of debarred vendors. In addition, anytime that you have a contract or a project that's funded with federal dollars, you need to include language in the contract documents that tell the vendor that this is federally sourced, which comes with some additional requirements on their end. And you had used an existing or an open PO in one case where you had an open PO for projects that weren't federally sourced, but you used it to buy some items that were reimbursed under the grant. And at that point, you need to let that vendor know that this is federally sourced, and that didn't happen. So those are two related. And then the final one was sometimes you outsource activities under these grants and you work with another agency to actually do services. And when you do that, there's still a federal taint to those dollars when they pass through to the other organization, so they have some compliance requirements as the city does. When you do that, you have one additional one, which is to monitor those other agencies or subrecipients to ensure that they are meeting the federal requirements. And we found instances under this JAG cluster programs where the subrecipient monitoring was not happening. So that will need to be addressed. So out of all the federal dollars and all the programs, just a couple findings relative to one of the programs that we tested. In terms of communications, again, you've got a letter from us that has all of them written, and I'll just highlight there's a couple that governing boards like to hear from us. One is, gosh, you did all this work. Did you have any difficulties? Did our management staff put up roadblocks, or were they non-responsive, or were there problems? And I'm pleased to report to you that we did not have any significant problems with management and the performance of the audit. We find your staff very responsive, pretty dedicated individuals. Clearly, there were some findings this year, some improvements that could be made, but we really appreciate the tone and the attitude of your staff. They want to know and benefit from our observations and recommendations, and we don't get an attitude or a tone or a, oh gosh, here come the auditors. We don't experience that at all, so appreciate that. We need to tell you if there are audit adjustments or if there are some misstatements that didn't get corrected. And so that's in the communication to you. And there were no audit adjustments. In other words, our audit procedures did not trip over significant errors that required adjustments. There were some uncorrected misstatements which are identified in the letter. They were immaterial to the financials. Two of those were found by your staff. They brought them to our attention, and we talked about how to handle that. Corrections were made in the current year instead of restating prior years. So there's an uncorrected misstatement just in not going back and restating prior year financial statements. Given the dollars involved, it made the most sense just to run that correction through the current year, and we agreed with that. One case was an error that we had identified, but again, it was immaterial, and it would have required a restatement of prior years. Management opted not to do that. We concurred, but all three of those now are corrected as of the end of the year, so there's going to be no ongoing issue from those, provided similar mistakes aren't made in the future. So the rest of those I'll let you read, but those are provided to you. Finally, I mentioned that we often issue what we call a management letter. So it really is a letter to management. These are items that deserve their attention, or we try to provide them with best practice observations and recommendations. But there was one this year that I thought you might want to be aware of. You play clearly a critical role in this, and it's related to the graphs that were handed out to you. So if you could look at that. Also, it's interesting, I get questions sometimes, you know, this is a big document. It's a lot to read and comprehend. You know, what if you had someone come to you and say, you know, that would be a lot to read through. If I had 15 minutes, what pages could I turn to and really get a sense of the financial condition of the city? And what I say is, turn to that statistical section in the back. You've got a statistical section there that your crew puts together. It's not required to be in a financial statement, but it's excellent information. In the first series of tables in there are the financial trends. And the graphs that I handed to you come from the tables, a couple of the tables that are in that statistical section. What I wanted to point out about it is on the graph that's the general fund balance. So these are the cash and investments and assets that can fund your current operations. you've got a graph of what that ending fund balance has been for the last 10 years. And you'll see that the city has done a very good job of maintaining the resources necessary. There are some best practice recommendations that you maintain at least 10% of the revenues that go into the general fund, that's retained at the end of the year to fund operations and to provide a buffer in case unforeseen things happen. At the end of 2012, you had $77 million in the general fund. That represents, I think, somewhere between 13 and 14% of your revenues that were deposited in that fund. So you're well above the 10% best practice recommendation, and you get excellent bond ratings as a result of the ability to maintain that fund balance. The interesting thing, though, is that in your general fund, the accounting rules, this is basically cash in and cash out. So not all of the assets and liabilities are reflected in this. If you flip the page, this is a graph now. When you take all of the general government activities and you put the statements together similar to a commercial enterprise, this graph shows you what the equity or the trend, the long-term trend, and what this shows is that you had about $1.8 billion of net assets back in 2002, and that's now down to $520 million at the end of 2012. So what this represents is costs that the city has incurred where you've been able to put off the payment of that, the incurrence of some new debt, and also the wear and tear on capital assets that you use in general government operations where you haven't made the reinvestment yet. So the wear and tear. And I guess we want to bring this to your attention because we'd like for you to reach out to your staff, finance staff, and ask some more questions about these trends and what they mean and what you should know about them. Is it time to look at some of the financial policies of the city to determine if they're appropriate for the values that you have and share, what is there a way to look at the longer-term impacts of the current decisions that you're making to make sure that we're not putting off too much of the costs we're incurring today to future generations? So we'd like to encourage you just to talk more with finance staff and for the bureaus to have discussions about the longer-term impacts of the decisions that are made today, in addition to just the current impact that it has on the general fund, for example.
Can I just zero in on that for a sec? Because I appreciate that you're calling this out and you're encouraging us to have these conversations, but my mind works better around concrete.
Sure.
So could you give us a, for instance, you've sure. identified some trends and some concerns. Can you boil it down to a specific example or even just...
Yeah, well, I can actually give you three. You know, if you look at the numbers, there's $1.8 billion of net assets 10 years ago. It's down to $520 million today. So what's that, $1.3 billion decrease. Almost 600,000 of that is the reduction in the value of the city's capital assets. So your infrastructure, buildings, equipment, roads, the wear and tear has increased or has outpaced the reinvestment or replacement to the tune of about $600 million. That's a piece of it. Probably the biggest piece is the police, fire, and pension fund. As you know, that was funded on a pay-as-you-go basis instead of funded on a current basis. So you were incurring cost but not setting resources aside yet. So that's a big part of it. That was about $760 million, I think. And then you've incurred some debt. So your debt has increased almost $300 million over this 10 years. So you've borrowed some money. So those are three concrete areas, perhaps.
And so if I could, the $600 million that you've identified in the reduction in value of capital assets,
yeah.
So that would match up with the annual report that we get that shows, I think the figure is about $160 million where we annually fall short of meeting our needs around capital investment?
I think that's directly related, correct.
It's accruing and adding to that total.
Right.
Yeah. And this is exclusive of PES.
Correct. This does not include
investments in the big pipe, because right. that would destroy.
Correct.
This
does not include what we call your business type activities, which is the sewer and water, Portland International Raceway, golf courses, you know, those things that tend to have revenue streams, charges for services that cover those. So this is just the general government side. Yeah.
Well, just maybe related to that, you had us turn to the statistical section.
Yeah.
And so the first chart there talks about total assets.
Huh?
Of, I guess in the trillions of dollars, a couple trillion. Is that including the value of all of our property, including our sewer and water system and all that?
Correct.
But it's going to be a billion.
That represents the net book value of all the assets minus the liabilities. If you were to liquidate everything at book value and pay off the debts, that represents a number that would be left over.
Correct.
Although I don't think, my recollection is we still don't include the value of trees.
That's correct.
That's right.
Actually, I know that it brings a lot of chuckles, but I have to tell you there's a lot of interest in environmental or green accounting, if you will. Utilities, I mean, I know your own department is interested in this. Not trees are one thing, but there's a bigger picture. All the watershed, you know, all the things that contribute to the ability to generate water and have access to water, the accounting doesn't recognize the fair value of all of that. And it's become an issue because people want access to credit markets to help finance activities related to this green infrastructure, and right now the markets don't always exist that acknowledge that value. It's like they want a hard asset, that you a building that you build, and then I can borrow money to finance that project. But anyway, that's beyond today's topic.
Well, since you went there, one of the issues is the Government Accounting Standards Board has to decide that that's permissible to value?
Correct. So I just recently was appointed to the Governmental Accounting Standards Advisory Council. Mm-hmm. It's a mouthful. Our task is to provide feedback to the Governmental Accounting Standards Board on setting their priority. What should their priorities be for what projects they take on? And in our last meeting, which was just a couple weeks ago, this green environmental accounting issue came on the agenda. There's about 25 members that have representatives that sit on this committee that I sit on. I represent the American Institute of CPAs. So everyone represents a particular group that's involved in the governmental realm. Anyway, what I can tell you about that is that we took a vote on what GASB's priorities ought to be, and that project did not get one vote, unfortunately, for those that are very interested in that topic. So there were other projects, 10 in particular, that got a lot of votes. So it'll be, I suspect, it'll be a while before GASB gets enough feedback that that should move up on its priority list.
But the fact that they're talking about it is great.
Yeah, that is good.
Anyway, other questions? I have a much smaller picture, a couple of questions about your findings. I think it's on page 343 and 344, you've got a couple of findings about the Portland Development Commission's practices with respect to both tax increment revenue and the value of property. You mentioned that you did get a chance to present your findings already to the PDC.
Correct.
Any response yet on those issues? So.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, some of these issues were brought to our attention, again, by PDC staff. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a couple representatives here if you'd like to talk to them, but no, they are very proactive. As they identified these issues and brought them to our attention, they were already working on potential solutions. On the ones that we brought to their attention, they've been very proactive. I believe they have an action plan already identified for all of these, and they're well along their way towards addressing these particular issues.
Okay. Well, since she's here, we might get her to come up later and give us a quick response on that.
Can I also ask another question? You mentioned with respect to the general fund that we have some guidelines that govern what an appropriate reserve is, and you noted 10%, and you also observed that having an appropriate level of general fund reserves affects our credit ratings, right, and other things, so that the overall health of the body is enhanced when we maintain those levels. So
that's correct.
So I appreciate that, and it, but it begs a question in my mind that's probably harder to quantify, which is, how do we measure what an appropriate level of debt is for a municipality to incur, and to what extent do you, in assessing debt, take into consideration what the debt is securing? In other words, good debt, bad debt, what's the asset that the public is receiving, and how do you measure whether it is, we have the right balance? And could you give us just some of your thinking about what some generally accepted guideposts are in other cities our size?
Boy, that's a loaded question. Well, I can tell you that for the most part, the way that governments tend to evaluate what's the right amount or the okay debt is, do I have the revenue stream to repay it? And am I jeopardizing the ability to deliver service by dedicating the resources necessary to repay that debt? And when it comes to, for example, if you're a business type activities, so the sewer, water, I think the level of debt has tripled over the last 10 years. But, you know, they've been able to set rates that have covered current operations and been able to repay that debt. So there, I think the question becomes, is my rate, how do my rates compare? Am I, you know, the highest sewer and water rate of any community that I compare myself against in order to generate that revenue stream to repay it? So I'm not giving you concrete. The other thing I can tell you, though, is that there are some guidelines that exist. You're a member of the Government Finance Officers Association, as an example. You're very active in that. In fact, you've had Ken Rust, I think, was prez for a while of that organization. So you've had ongoing involvement. Anyway, they establish some best practices or policies around debt. I believe that you, who else did? You had Eric Johansson for a while, also on staff, I think recently retired. But he was a member of the debt committee of GFOA, and you had the benefit of his knowledge and experience in that to help with your debt management, a very knowledgeable individual. But they established best practices and some guidelines, and I believe through Eric you were bringing those back to the city. But those are good questions. I think what I would encourage you to do is to reach out to your staff and your debt finance staff and find out what those best practices are and how you compare.
Well, let me just say that we've been having a healthy debate in the city for a few years about this question, and it often comes under the guise of sustainability.
Right.
And what I think is often missing in the discussion is the distinction between good debt and bad debt, and then what is the debt securing? For example, I have a mortgage on my house. It allows me to experience the dream of home ownership. Lots of other people do. We generally view that in society as reasonable debt. If I take out a sucker's loan through my credit card to pay my monthly operating expenses, that's bad debt because it's going down the drain and I'm just... And I think if you have other thoughts or if you have citations to things you want us to look at, it's an active area of discussion and debate about how you quantify and evaluate debt. And I'd be interested in how other cities objectively are measuring debt.
Well, you know, one of the debts that you have isn't really official debt. It's not a bond that you issued. But when you think about the FPD&R, for example, that pension fund, you know, years ago when that was established, the decision was made that as long as we had a revenue stream that could cover the benefit checks as people retired and needed to secure benefits, that we were okay. And I don't know if there was really the question about, well, is that the best policy? Or should we be funding that like you attempt to fund pension plans on a current basis? So the total cost that we're incurring or that we've offered employees is really being covered through the rates and the revenue stream currently. So a decision was made, you know, not to do that, but you've rectified that. So you, a number of years ago, you changed your policy. All the new members of the police and fire are going into Oregon PERS, which is pre-funded. So there'll be that period of time where you address that challenge, but at least you've changed that policy. That is an example of, well, was that the best decision we could have made at the time?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good.
I could just say that PDC's report
Turn on your mic.
Oh, sorry. Fiona Earle, PDC's response is on page 352 to those two findings, Mr. Mayor.
Ah, there it is. Okay, good. Great. Other questions?
Gosh, good questions.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank